The next case on our calendar is 95-2591 and 2594-2596, Sharon Village Limited versus Licking County Board of Revision. Mr. Slakes.
Legal concepts involved in property valuation and the various ways that that is done, and the legal sufficiency, and witnesses, and the confidence, and what about all that?
Well, I think that when we are at the local level for the county board of revision, that it's much more informal proceeding. In case of the council, this part comes through either the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals or from the Court of Appeals and an appeal from the Court of Common Pleas. And it is in those forms that the real property tax assessment case becomes a much more formal civil proceeding. When we're at the board of revision level, it's a much more informal proceeding, and the board of revision is only required to keep minutes of the proceeding and documents are submitted. So I think that the statutory scheme has been set out by the General Assembly for purposes of hearing these complaints necessarily implies that it's a more informal proceeding. As a result, I don't think that the issue that comes before this part necessarily goes raised by the Board of Revision, because, as I mentioned, none of the Board of Revision members have any special legal training, and primarily you come into the hearing and you explain the process.
Well, I've attended hearings, I think others have too. I wouldn't necessarily agree that it's informal, that this isn't a proceeding that is had this structure, that the folks are prepared, and the witnesses are there, and the prosecutors quite often represented, and, you know, I guess that claim that it's so informal.
I think it varies from county to county.
Sure.
I mean, there's no question that under the statute, the Board of Revision does have the discretion to invite the prosecutors to advise in any matter. But I think you would find that in the 88 counties throughout the state,
are the members of the panel completely detached from the collection of taxes in that county? Do they have any interest in the subject matter in which they're hearing?
Yes, they do. And this court recognized that in the Alliance Tower case, because the property owner in the Alliance Tower case raised that due process concern that if I have to go in and challenge my assessment before the county auditor makes the assessment, the county treasurer collects the taxes, and the county commission will spend the money, that I've got kind of a biased tribunal. And the court recognized that, and they said that the statutory scheme that the General Assembly established, whereby you appeal right, from the Board of Revision decision to either the Board of Tax Appeals or the Court of Common Pleas, alleviates any type of a due process concern.
But if that causes the landowner an additional appeal, if he doesn't like the results, that causes him additional monies, causes him additional time. He's the one that's appealing if he gets a bad rap, correct?
That's correct.
And if you usually win it down in the trial court. There's an old saying, if you don't win it at the trial court, you're probably not going to win it going up. So why shouldn't we be concerned about the procedures and the rulings made at the hearing to protect the landowner from getting a result that would be impossible to reverse?
Well, because the nature of the proceeding, when you go to the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals or the Court of Common Pleas, this court has interpreted the statutes that provide for the party to submit additional evidence, that provide for de novo review, and that those Board of Tax Appeals and the Court of Common Pleas are to render an independent determination without giving any weight to the determination by the Court.
My point is that you're causing the landowner to go to another level of review if he loses, aren't you? You're saying, oh, wait a minute, now if he gets the wrong decision, he's always got a chance to get it reversed upstairs, correct? Well, why should the landowner have the additional expense and step to have to appeal it when he should be able to get a just and a verdict from the panel? And you admitted that three people on the panel really aren't too detached from the subject matter, are they?
I agree with you. I agree that we have a somewhat biased panel of the court.
Well, wouldn't a lawyer protecting the interest of the landowner in the initial phase save a lot of trouble and a lot of expense for that landowner?
Not really, Your Honor.
Appeal?
No, not really, because the question before the Board of Revision is really just the value of the property, and the attorney really brings very little to the Board of Revision.
Is that all just merely the value of the property? That's the only question. That's a pretty big question, isn't it?
In most cases, Your Honor.
We're talking about a lot of money in most cases. And you sort of, you know, throw it off like it's only a valuation of property.
Well, I'm not belittling the concerns of a property owner when it goes in before the Board of Revision, but what I'm saying is that in terms of the nature of the proceeding, which is really not directly an issue in these cases, because the only involvement of the county consultant in this case was the filing of a complaint. Either an attorney handled the hearing or the property owner handled the hearing before the Board of Revision. So if something went wrong at the Board of Revision, the property owner and these appeals will either blame the attorney or blame himself.
And I'm concerned about it from that earlier point. Justice Sweeney and Justice Cook are going into the merits of the thing, what happens there, and I think that's proper. But I'm concerned even before that. If we have statutes of limitation on filing notices of appeal, and we do, and if a CPA files it late, and the client is injured, sues the CPA, and the carrier for the CPA says that's the practice of law, we're not responsible.
Well, I think that we do have a statute of limitations, just as we have, we've got the time to file the taxes.
I ought to tell you, the statute of limitations for accountants in Ohio is different than for everybody else.
Right.
You're favored with a 4-year statute with no discovery rule, when all the rest of us have to be subject to the discovery rule by a majority vote of this court.
Right. But I don't think that the time constraint of March 31st is necessarily dispositive of whether the filing of the refund test was going to want to be in practice of law. I think that the court in the decisions that have been cited in recent other contexts have looked at what type of knowledge or skill was necessary to prepare and file a complaint.
Well, what would happen with my example? You file the notice of appeal late.
Right. And the property owner would be against the tax consultant.
Guess who? The tax consultant? For what? Malpractice or negligence? Okay. And now the carrier says, the insurance company if the CPA is insured, or the accountant's insured, says, oh, that's the practice of law. You're involved in a legal judicial proceeding.
Right.
So we are paying. Then where are we?
The accountant would be personally
liable.
You wouldn't have insurance for that.
And what if it weren't a CPA? What if it's a realtor? What if it's an appraiser, an MIA, somebody who doesn't carry coverage for this sort of thing, which we, hope and believe most attorneys have? That's a bigger issue.
But I'm not aware of any cases where the court has looked at malpractice or malfeasance coverage as a basis for determining whether it's something in the practice of law. I don't see that as being something that the court decisions that have been cited in this case is what.
Of course, you're citing things like the informality of the hearing, as we mentioned before.
Well, that's one of the aspects with respect to the complaint form, and the court has looked with respect to doing title searches and that sort of thing, that if it's just factual information, the recording of factual information and not getting any special legal, that is not the practice of law. I think also, with respect to the Board of Revision proceeding, and the concerns that Justice Sweeney expressed with respect to anything that may go awry in that proceeding, that we do have the right of appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals and the Board of Common Pleas. But more importantly, I think that as the Board of longstanding practice.
Counsel, I want to back up a second. You want to understand your claim to be that in all of these cases that are before us, the only thing that an attorney did on behalf of a taxpayer was file the original complaint. Once the complaint was filed, either the landowner or an attorney or both were present at the hearings, filed the papers, did whatever took place after that, both at the Board of Revision and at the BTA.
That's correct.
I guess I'm the issue that I'm focused on is whether or not a layman's filing ought to be jurisdictional matter rather than a matter for this court to determine if we determine that that is in fact the practice of law, offering up sanctions for engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, but to allow the appeal process to go forward.
Well, I think that I would agree that if there was some wrong, and I think that it has essentially what was the basis for the Cleveland Bar Association for renewal. The feeling of the Cleveland Bar Association and the activities of the court are not so effective as law.
Did this person who filed, or this company who filed, how are they compensated?
They're compensated on
On a contingent fee basis. Well, that sure does sound like the practice of law, doesn't it?
Well, this court did review contingency appraisal work in the Witt case, and I think it's unclear in that case whether the court said.
Well, no, wait a minute. You said contingency appraisal.
Yeah.
That could be a whole different matter.
Well, I agree with that. If you read the record in this case, I believe that they are the major service. Once he made an estimate of the value of the property, he filed a claim on behalf of the property.
So he gets paid based on the adjustment, and he provides an appraisal.
That's right.
And his reward is if I can sell this appraisal to reviewing authorities, I get a chunk of it. Is that common?
Well, I would say that there are, I think you could come up with many different ways that.
In the world of appraisal that I'm familiar with, a contingent fee appraisal would be instantly suspect, wouldn't it?
And I think the court recognized that the great credibility issue in the Greek case, but it did not serve the basis for including consideration of appraisal. And the use path to become standard with the appraisal practice, which is mentioned by the Appraisal Foundation, does govern appraisers, does allow the appraisal work so long as it's disclosed to the appraiser. The International Association of Assessing Officers, which is the worldwide association of county auditors, in their ethical rules also does allow the appraisal.
Does or does not?
It does.
Does it?
It does allow it. It's ethical rule 4-2. And so not only does the appraiser, the County Auditors Association allow us to do it.
Yeah, I mean, just my reaction, that's almost an oxymoron to me to say it is ethical but have it continue to be appraisal. I'm very troubled with it.
Well, so long as it's disclosed, I'm not arguing that it's not something that the finder of that and evaluation proceeding could play. But I think that issue was squarely before this court, which in the case, which did not find the legal consent to that statement, did not find that there was anything that would provide across the board throwing out of appraisal on a fee basis. The last point that I would like to touch on with the board
Thank you, Mr. Sleggs. In fact, you've used all your time. Mr. Thompson, I'll give you a minute, and then you'll have about 30 seconds for rebuttal.
May I please support counsel? My name is Anthony Thompson. I'm licensed in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and I've been retained by the Institute of Property Taxation and the National Council of Property Tax Consultants, which joined me to file an amicus brief, urging a reversal of the Board of Tax Appeals' decision in this matter. And I respectfully suggest, Your Honors, that a reading of the Board of Tax Appeals' own opinion would invite its own reversal. Your Honors, please, the reason why we have a requirement that only licensed attorneys are permitted to practice law rests upon the very sound policy that the public must be protected. But I respectfully suggest that the requirement of attorney involvement not be carried to an unreasonable extent, an unwarranted extent, where it impinges upon another very sound public policy. Mainly the taxpayers at the county board level who challenge their assessments need to be given an efficient and inexpensive and informal method to challenge those assessments. When we make a determination as to whether or not attorney involvement is required in an administrative proceeding, I respectfully suggest it's not very helpful to rely upon generalized academic definitions of the so-called practice of law. Rather, we should look to the specific conduct and charges of each of a particular administrative agency to see whether or not attorney participation is or is not required. And I respectfully suggest a three-part criteria.
You need to do it very quickly.
Three tests. First of all, Your Honors, what are the essential nature of the issues? Are they formal or informal? Second, how about the participants of the adjudicating agency? Are the attorneys required to be attorneys licensed or not? Third, very important issue, is the application of trained legal skills necessary? Note I please say necessary and not merely helpful or useful, but is the application of trained legal skills necessary in order to assemble the facts and come to the conclusions? I respectfully suggest it is not in these proceedings. Taxpayers should have that freedom of choice. I thank the court for allowing me to argue.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Rich.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Rich. I'm the attorney for the Newark City School Board of Education. I'm honored to be associated today with Assistant County Prosecutor Pauline O'Neill, who's the uncle who was once Chief Justice of this court. And James Gorey, who's going to have a few minutes at the end to talk to you on behalf of the Ohio State Bar Association, the State Auditors Association, the Franklin County Auditor.
Mr. Rich,
yes,
could you argue that you meet the tests just outlined by counsel, the three tests? Do you remember what they were? Essential nature is informal. That the tribunal is essentially made up of non-legally trained folks. And the third one is, does it require the application of trained legal skills?
Having just heard that, I haven't had time to analyze it. It's a new concept to me. But what I want to emphasize to you is that, to use the Shakespearean bard's play, this is much ado about nothing. What has happened since you refused to certify the record in the prior case in 1994 is that tax representatives are no longer signing complaints before the Board of Revision because they're afraid they're all going to get thrown out. And therefore, the problem that ensued up till 1994 has gone out of existence. To reverse the Board of Tax Appeals in this matter would be a major step backwards. It would again throw these tax representatives into the center of the fray at the beginning to the creation of the signing and the filing of these Board of Revision complaints. And really, this case is about only one issue, and that is who has the right to sign and file Board of Revision complaints pursuant to 5715-13.
And that's, and I'm glad you're bringing that up, because how do you equate the phrase is for his agent, and how do we read in there that it has to be an attorney?
It doesn't have to be an attorney. That section specifically says that it has to read to you from that, the relevant part, that the party who filed a decrease in valuation complaint, the county board of revision shall not decrease any valuation complaint of unless the party affected thereby or his agent makes and files with the board a written application, therefore verified under oath, showing the facts. Who can verify under oath and who can show the facts? You must do both. Can an outsider? I've heard board of revisions call these types, some of these tax agents, as contingent-free bounty hunters. They have no knowledge about the property. None whatsoever.
Well, a lawyer doesn't have any more knowledge than an agent does.
But specifically, a lawyer is excluded from that provision about facts by the tax commissioner's rulings that lawyers may sign these complaints, even though they may not have the knowledge of the facts that an owner would. Because we are bound to make certain by our ethical considerations that we don't file frivolous complaints, that we learn enough from our clients.
Well, but the jury,
there is a basis upon which we can make.
But if a document is notarized, the person is swearing that the facts in the document are true. That doesn't, you don't have to be a lawyer to be bound by that, do you?
In this particular case, I believe you do, because it's the type of facts that you're swearing to are facts about the value and your knowledge about this property. And the agent that is referred to in 5715.13 is the property agent, an agent who has personal knowledge over those facts, an agent who is involved in the property. That is similar to a Rule 65 verified complaint. We say that you have to have personal knowledge to swear.
I don't think
sign verified complaints. My client signs a verified complaint. That's what this is.
So is it your contention that the if a person was the land agent or an agent for, say, a apartment complex, that person could do what the appellants want to do here?
Absolutely.
It's the fact that there's this entrepreneurial group out here that's going around. Their only business is to say we'll assess your property and for a contingent fee we'll try and get you a decrease in the valuation.
That's
what's.
And I believe that it's against the public policy of the state of Ohio to encourage this. The reversal of this decision would encourage this. Because these property tax agents who are working on this basis they don't want to show the complaint to their owner because it's going to be an inconvenience, but more importantly, because the owner might say, my gosh, where did you get that figure?
Okay.
So maybe I shouldn't even file this complaint. Is this all the auditor?
Well, I understand your policy argument, but the difficulty I'm having is seeing how we draw a distinction between the practice of law and not the practice of law based upon the fact that an agent who knows the property can sign one of these and file it, and an agent who is entrepreneurial, for lack of a better term, can't do it. That seems to me a rather artificial, a policy-driven sort of way to draw the line.
We have specific statutes and we have general statutes. The general is 470501. The specific is 5715.13. That takes precedence. That says that the owner or somebody affected thereby or his agent can file these complaints. Specifically says that, and they must be verified. So what we have here is we have the commencement of an action about property that you either own or someone on your behalf who has great knowledge of it can commence that action. But if you don't qualify under that statute, as these property tax owners don't, I mean the non-owners don't, these agents, then you go to the more general statutes, 470501 and the unauthorized practice of law. That's where they fail on all three. Tax agents fail on all three, but the person who works for the owner doesn't fail on number one, which is a specific statute, and therefore he prevails.
So it's your contention that the General Assembly intended that the owner, or if the owner through someone who essentially works for the owner or manages the property or whatever, that's either one of those can file. That's the attention of the General Assembly, and the attention does not go beyond that, I guess.
That's right. The key words, Your Honor, are personal knowledge. Do the people who are signing on behalf of this owner, either the owner or someone else, have personal knowledge of the facts? If they do, they qualify under 5715.13. If they don't, then we have to look at the next two levels, 470501 or your obligations under the unauthorized practice of law. And if they don't qualify under any of those, they are out. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I guess
devil's advocate on this for a little bit. And I guess I'm not so troubled by someone filing it if they put the proper information on the forms and fill it out to reference. So let me just deal with that first. I'm more troubled by pursuing it after that and whether or not the remedy could ever be dismissal. On these, what about an MAI appraiser who's going out for a fee, looks at the request of a property owner, says, I have a question about how much I'm being taxed. Go take a look at this property. Do your due diligence. Can that person who's not an attorney properly file this form directed to, by the property owner?
Absolutely not. And we don't see that happening. We don't see MAI.
They could or could not.
They could not.
They could not.
They do not. And they have not since the 1973 Attorney General's opinion that said that's the unauthorized practice of law. MAIs don't want to be charged.
So they just, you just flat have to be a lawyer, period.
Or the owner or someone with knowledge of, personal knowledge about it. And let me explain to you, though, why, Your Honor, why I think that's so important, the original signature, which is really the only thing this case is about. What do you have to advise somebody if they're not the owner or have personal knowledge? What do you have to advise them about? What's going to happen if you file a complaint? One, you could get an increase.
Yeah.
What do you mean I could get an increase?
Okay.
Well, you could get an increase.
Not
your substantive rights could be affected. You might not present the proper evidence on appeal, you lose.
The flip side of that is that you, your firm, and other attorneys on behalf of school districts and others are engaged in a somewhat similar practice on the other side of the coin, are you not?
Absolutely not. I know none of them work, first of all, on a contingency basis. But secondly, we advise our clients about all the risks and hazards in every one of these cases.
But you are filing these complaints.
Absolutely, because we are allowed to sign on behalf of the clients. If it weren't that way, we would have our clients.
Because you're an attorney.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there any comparison here with what goes on in the workers' comp area, where you have Gates McDonald, others representing employers? I assume those folks aren't attorneys, and they help look out for the employer's interests through all of those hearings. That would not be dissimilar, would they, in terms of the knowledge of the law and all of those things that are required to represent in there?
Well, having never practiced in the workers' comp area, I'm not sure of the nature of the body of law, but I do know exactly the risks and hazards that any taxpayer or any school system gets involved in if they become a party to an action that has to do with the value of their property. And that is why you need an attorney at the beginning, or you have to know yourself what are the risks and hazards. These are adversarial proceedings. They're an examination of expert witnesses.
Why shouldn't the right remedy here, though, be to use our powers to go after these folks for unauthorized practice of law, to say in an opinion that contingent fee appraisals should be given little or no weight in these hearings, but to allow the properly filed complaints or the properly filled out complaints to go forward if the property owner and or lawyer picks up and carries the ball at that point. Why is dismissal the right remedy for the infraction that occurs here?
It's a very good question, Your Honor. It's solely because it violates the specific statute, 57-15-13, that says you have to verify the complaint, verify the facts, which means you must swear that you know that these facts are true from your own personal knowledge. If you can't qualify under that, which they cannot if they're a tax representative and have no connection previously with the property except the desire to share in some benefits they might receive from lowering the taxes, they cannot sign that under 57-15-13. Then you go to the next area, the ones that have to do with the unauthorized practice of law, which you and you alone govern, and 4705-01, which the legislature said to commence a proceeding, you must be a licensed attorney. And when we have a record, as we do in the Board of Revision, which may become the record that is binding forever, you may never have new evidence. If you screw up in the beginning, you may never be able to win your case, and under the law, you can only file once in a three-year period. So now all of a sudden, because a non-lawyer advised this person to file a complaint, incompetently prepared it and presented it, the individual who owns the property has lost the ability to try and get their taxes re-examined.
So you're troubling me because you're making these general broad accusations that these people are basically slimeballed. That's what you're saying. They don't verify their stuff. They're incompetent. They lie to their clients. They hide evidence. That I don't think is in the record. Can you point you to the record that says that that's the type of deceptive practice that they're using?
I'm certainly not suggesting that that is a widespread practice by all of them.
Well,
I'm saying
a rather broad generalization.
Well, I would say this particular appellant in this case has that kind of reputation. There are others who do this kind of work, CPAs and others, who do not have that reputation. But there are some who do have that reputation. And in particular, in this case, I believe that that is correct. But the important thing is that do they, when they sign that complaint, do they properly advise their clients about their rights and obligations?
Do you know that they do or don't?
Pardon me?
Do you know that they do or don't?
We know that they don't let them sign it, so we don't. We know that they don't let them sign it.
Is that evidence in the case?
Yes, the complaint is signed by Mr. Parabek, not by the owner.
And you say that he had no personal knowledge. Does that mean that if somebody goes out, personally examines the property, personally goes out and pulls the tax record, sits down and has a conference with the client, and then declares that that doesn't qualify as personal knowledge?
That is not the personal knowledge necessary to verify a verified complaint under Rule 65.
What's qualified then? What's required?
What's required is you, of your own personal knowledge, you are the property manager. They send the checks to you. You put them on the roster. Here is the rents that are paid. I go out and I fix the toilets or hire a plumber to do it. I manage the property or I own the property. That is what you need to verify a complaint. That is personal knowledge.
I'm sorry, I don't buy that.
I wanted to save some time for Mr. Gorey. I just want to urge you not to go back and backtrack from what is a public policy of the state of Ohio that has been accepted as a result of the 1994 decision by this body not to certify the record in the prior case, so that tax agents are no longer signing complaints. Property owners are. We believe it will eliminate frivolous complaints and be in the public's best interest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rich. Mr. Gorey.
Chief Justice, I thank you, Your Honor. My name is James Gorey.
Okay, can you?
Mr. Rich, that somebody has to go out and repair their shutters and clean their toilets to qualify as an agent?
I totally agree with what the principal Mr. Rich was making. 57.15.13 is the section we require to verify the complaints and requires the complaint to set forth facts for which he speaks. Now, perhaps I can clarify it by saying what those facts are. Before the appraiser would be appraised the property. Justice Rabbit, if you owned a commercial piece of property, small apartment complex, you were going to have it appraised. The first thing the appraiser would say to you is, I want you to rent it. I want you to pay for it. Tell me a little bit about the position of the property. Tell me when you last bought the piece of property. In the appraisal profession, the appraiser is not required to get that information. But in the tax business, the law says that information must be verified. We've seen from the Gates Mills case, for instance, before this court, that if board of revision doesn't get that information verified, then people in the state are getting the illegal property tax reductions. So that's the key. The individual who signs the complaint has to say, and the records are supposed to be attached to the expense statement. They're not, but nonetheless, the individual who says that the property is overvalued because of the income doesn't support the value is supposed to say under oath that this is the income, these are the residents. That's the data that must be verified. That's the truth and the accuracy that we need from the press. And that is what is good for that. So that's the data we need. It's not some appraiser who says, well, in my opinion, we need is the data of the appraiser, the income and expense statements, the rental. We have to have that. If we're to verify, we have to have some means that this is confirmed information to you accurately.
And the client represents to the person representing him, this is all true and accurate. We don't think that's the
case. Absolutely not. And we know that from Gage Mills. And Gage Mills, the attorney, filed the complaint, submitted the income and expense. The Board of Revision relied on it and approved, granted a reduction in value. And then everyone subsequently awarded the income and expense and above. And the owner kept.
Yeah. That happened to an attorney as well as it happened to an appraiser. The client likes it, the client likes it.
Justice Stratton, you'd like the word said. When the property owner comes to you and says, I want to file a complaint, fill it out. The disciplinary rules say, you've got to exercise. You've got to inquire into the facts. You can't go signing a complaint as an attorney. We don't know anything about it. So there's some protection. It's the same when the owner is there. There's some protection. The owner is verifying that the complaint is based on the facts and answers. And that's the report of the real property tax system. We need that data. We operate on the truth of that data. We've got to have some data to keep that data to that. We can't have some of these factors mopping together these things. Combine them.
Mr. Gore, I'm sorry, were you finished? I'm interested in the amicus here, one of your clients, the county auditors. They obviously have an interest in this, file a brief. What is their underlying interest? Why do they want lawyers to file these pieces of paper instead of non-lawyers?
Justice, the county auditors are convinced that since prior we have had significantly fewer frivolous complaints being filed by taxes. We think the requirement of property owners on complaints or the attorney on complaints has reduced frivolous complaints. These taxes are in the business of soliciting property owners to file their complaints. Now, soon, we are going to have every single commercial piece of property in the state being handled by a tax agent. The owner has nothing to lose. Tax agent says to the owner, I will file a complaint. I will do the appraisal. I will cover all the expenses. It can't be in maintenance.
Why does your national association say contingent fee appraisals are all right?
There isn't a board commission in the state that relies on contingent fee appraisals. The BTA, for example, does. And that commission is the public support. So,
you wouldn't be getting any indication how that might be decided, would you?
Good. That's the right answer. Good. Thank you, Mr. Gorey. Mr. Slakes, you've used your time, but you may take a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, in response to your question, there is concern about there not being any
these complaints that necessarily puts someone who can be providing a legitimate service, and that is looking at the duplicates, looking at property and saying to property owners, you know, I've looked at this and it looks to me like your taxes are out of line in relation to everybody else. Here's the service I can provide for you. Here's how I think I can help you out. Can't they still function? I mean, why is it essential that they sign the complaint?
I don't think that it is essential. I mean, you read the record in this case, it's for sure funny that he does not have the time to do this himself. He must rely on others to do the work for him. But he was fully informed of every stage of his proceeding because he was writing written authorization before the complaint was filed. He knew what the value was, what the auditor was claiming.
Why not have him sign the complaint? I mean, what's the magic?
Well, I think that if you read the transcript in this case, he has about 30 properties. He has many other responsibilities. And in fact, one of the vice presidents of the management company did oversee a lot of work on this case. The fact of the matter is you cannot have the general partner, you cannot always have the president of the corporation or officer involved. Real property in this state is owned by a multinational corporation, and you're not always going to be able to have.
I assume they find somebody who has the time to collect the rent. It would seem to me they could find somebody who has the time to sign the complaint.
Well, I think that the general decision provides some guidance to the court, and I think the very facts of this case provide a very example of how to
thank you, Mr. Slank. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.